1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
You're listening to Hard Knock Radio on the Pacifica Network. I'm Tonda Cizwe Chimaringa, guest hosting for Davey D while he's on vacation. Oscar Grant III was murdered 17 years ago on the Fruitvale BART station platform. What has happened when it comes to police violence and the struggle for justice and accountability in the U.S. since that time? Today, we'll be looking at that question and others with our guest, Kat Brooks, Bay Area organizer, co-founder and executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project. Kat, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me, Ms. Tondi. Good to be on with you.
Yeah, Oscar Grant, who will live forever. We will never forget him. We will never forget Oscar Grant. And some of us will never forget the movement for justice for Oscar Grant that arose in the wake of his New Year's Day murder on that BART platform. When we talk about a generation that was galvanized behind that murder, I know we were galvanized down here in LA, but you were here in the Bay Area. Talk about that time, if you can.
We'll probably get into it later, but I think I do want to preface what I say by generations were galvanized. And what I mean by that is that the struggle for justice for Oscar, which exploded in the streets of Oakland, California, and then, of course, when the court case in particular was moved to SoCal, also, you know, had folks in the streets in Los Angeles, was the fuse, was the match that lit the fuse for the last 17 years of sustained struggle against state violence, the longest in the history of this country, with that specific focus. And so I appreciated the introduction when you say, you know, before hashtags like Black Lives Matter made it into the mainstream, there is no Black Lives Matter without what Oakland did. There is no Black Lives Matter without the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant. There is no movement for Black Lives without the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant. There's no 2020, right? There's no 2020 exposed in the streets without the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant. And we are continuously, and I don't mean to sound whatever about it, but we are continuously written out of history. And so at every chance, I try to course correct historical narrative. So I just want to start there. The second thing that I'll say to kick us off is that there are a lot of nonprofits and organizers, et cetera, that try to take credit for the ignition of that movement. It's really important, I think, for people to understand that movement was kicked off by the streets, that there was an organic response from the masses, from Black and Brown young people that were sick and tired of being sick and tired. Took to the streets and said no more, right? In 2009, we were in the midst of a recession. And of course, Black people, poor people, get the worst of that.
Of course.
In California, the Oakland Police Department was murdering Black folks at every whip stitch, right? And it didn't really matter that Johannes Mezley, the cop that murdered Oscar, was a BART police officer. He was a cop. BART police in the Bay Area are notorious for harassing, haranguing, arresting, beating up, carting off to jail Black youth. And so I think you had a collision of a bunch of different factors, including the fact, right, that Oscar's execution was recorded, right? When social media was just sort of really becoming a way that we understood what was happening in the world around us. And so there wasn't a lot that could be said in terms of lies about what had happened to Oscar because it was all over the socials. And so this movement exploded in the streets very unapologetically. To which the state, the system, the establishment very quickly tried to quell it. And they used nonprofits to try to do that, which is why I feel like I have to course correct people saying that they or their organization or their coalition kicked off that movement. No, you didn't. the babies did. And then folks like myself came in later to provide organizing support. And then there were official coalitions that were formed, and there was there were organizers that were in the streets, and there were those of us, and Tanda, you're one of them, whose entire lives became consumed with the struggle for, I hate to say justice, because justice is Oscar Homer Wanda. That's justice.
That's true justice.
That's true justice, right? And that can't happen. So I say the struggle for accountability. It was a struggle for accountability, which some folks say we won. I push back on that a little bit. It was a year-long protracted struggle with the state. The people were literally at war with the state. And I don't think we talk about that enough either. And that's something I've been talking about this year, is what it cost people, relationships, sanity, physical impact, going to jail, being beaten up, eating tear gas, flashbangs. It was alphabet soup here in Oakland. FBI, CIA, ATF, OPD, the sheriffs, CHP, you name it. They were here, and they were at war with the people.
And we're probably going to have to do a marathon to dissect this movement, to look at all of the various pieces. Unfortunately, we can't do that today on Hard Knock, but I'm putting it out there. It needs to be done, because you mentioned so much. Each thing could be a branch to discuss, but you did put it in perspective. This has nothing to do with hateration or holleration. This precedes Black Lives Matter. It precedes the murder of Trayvon Martin. It precedes, as you says, not only does it precede 2020 and George Floyd, 2020 would not have happened without that movement galvanized by the murder of Oscar Grant. At least two of the things I wanted to speak with you about today was the proliferation of nonprofit, oxymoron here, nonprofit organizing around police violence since Oscar Grant was murdered. And then I'll get into the real reason I wanted to speak with you in a moment. But let's talk about these nonprofits. And you talked about nonprofits specifically in the Bay Area attempting to take credit for the organizing that was done around Oscar Grant. One of my concerns, one of my sore points, is how many nonprofit organizations have popped up, not just behind Oscar's murder, certainly beginning with Oscar's murder, but they don't confront police terror, even though that is the reason why their child, their loved one, is no longer here. That's the reason why their loved one was stolen. But in response to that, a nonprofit pops up that does any and everything except dealing with police terror. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so two things. There was a coalition called CAPE, Coalition Against Police Executions, that was made up of several nonprofits here that did help lead some of the early protests and did it with integrity. That said, I think that part of the dissolution of that coalition was because the streets could not be controlled. Right. And it becomes difficult for nonprofits. And there's people in that coalition that I love and I respect and I adore. And we are not the same. It becomes difficult for nonprofits to have their names on things when buildings are having their windows broken and things are being set on fire, right? Mm-hmm. And then so even though that is a rational reaction to unrational conditions. Mm. So one of the things that the state did, the establishment, city government did, was they pulled in some other nonprofits to try to control the young people. And so when the collective would call a protest, an action, they would then try to lure the young people inside, right? And they were being funded by the city to do this, to clear the streets. So it's important, I think, for people to understand that, as Taha Ak would say, the state isn't always smash and grab. A lot of times it's smooth and soothe. And so they were trying to smooth and soothe people into the streets and not have a real conversation, not only about Oscar Grant, but the fact that Oscar was one of many, right? People weren't just in the streets because of what happened to Oscar. People were in the streets because they were sick and tired of cops killing Black people. One after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other.
So, and no accountability.
And no accountability. And we are still there. I know we're going to get into this later, but we are still there. And part of why we are still there is because, to your point, since 2009 and really after 2020, we have seen nonprofits, C3s, pop up all over the place saying that they are going to fix America's policing problem. And that sentence right there is the problem. You're going to fix America's police. You can't fix what is not broken. You cannot fix.
Wait a minute now. What do you mean it's not broken?
I hate to use this cliche, but why break something why fix something that's not broken? This cliche is not broken, right? Policing is working exactly as it was intended. I'm sure that Davey's listeners know, folks that listen to you know, folks that listen to me certainly know, the origins of policing in this country. It was slave catchers and union crushing. It's always been about protecting profit at the expense of, and even at the characterization of, Black bodies as profit.
Well, now let me push back for a second. As of, I guess, last month, late 2025, independent documentation shows over 1,000 people are killed by police in the United States at least every year.
Yeah.
At minimum, 1,000 people every year. That's what's called a grim continuation of long-standing patterns of lethal force, according to the Police Brutality Center. Now, they're not all Black people.
Facts.
So when you say policing is working exactly as it's supposed to work, having evolved from slave patrols
and union crushing,
working people
in the North. Yep. Union crushing as well, working people. And so I would say the evolution of policing has been to become even more inclusive of who it identifies as the enemy. If you're talking sheer numbers, white people are killed more than any other demographic. It's per capita where Black folks launch ahead in terms of the numbers. But you have to look at the demographic of white people that are being murdered. It's poor white folks. They ain't going to Beverly Hills and gunning down white people. Right?
Yeah, I live out this way. I can't say that they are.
I know. That's why I use Beverly Hills and not Piedmont. I know where you live. It's
still now about- they might kill a white homeless dude in Venice Beach.
That part.
Downtown LA, Skid Row.
Police are the frontline agents to maintain the status quo of white supremacy, capitalism, imperialism. That's their job. Their job is to protect the status quo. And that's what they do by any means necessary. So these nonprofits that want to have this conversation about fixing American policing want to do so in a respectable way, but you can't have a respectable conversation about egregious behavior. They want to have the conversation without acknowledging the entire system of policing as an institution is a problem, right? We're still having that stupid bad apples conversation. And their funding is dependent on it. So my organization, the Anti-Police Terror Project, so I'm not a hypocrite, we are now currently a C3. Because I woke up to white guilt money in 2020. We were not a C3 for a very long time and actually never had any intention of being a C3. But what I can tell you is we didn't change our name, we didn't change our mission, and we didn't change our tactics, strategies, or motivations.
Let me really batten down my journalist cap for just one second. When you say a C3 and when we talk about nonprofits popping up in this quote-unquote battle against police terror, we're talking about organizations that are registered with the state and federal government as 501c3 non-lobbying organizations, non-profit organizations, not just a group of folks who come together grassroots to organize and fight back, but organizations that are officially registered with the state as a non-profit.
Yep.
Just wanted to for those Pacifica listeners who might not know, just wanted to throw that in there.
No, yeah, and no, and it's important. And when I say the reason why APTP became a C3 was because I woke up to white guilt money, is because there are laws around how much money you can take in, how you have to document it, what it can be used for, and the C structure protects people like me from going to prison. I woke up to several million dollars in an APTP account that previously had a budget of $4,000 a year. And I ran and handled that. That said, if you compare, let's say, APTP to, I'm trying to think of someone I can call out and not. Hey, Black Lives Matter Global. I can call them out. In terms of who will fund you, right? Like, so APTP could be sitting pretty right now. To say, sure, we'll work with the police to work on cultural competency trainings. Sure, we'll advocate for body cam footage. Sure, we'll go to city council and say, you know, we want more money for civilian engagement with law enforcement and to heal the ruptures in our community because we need to improve the trust between the police and the people. We would be sitting pretty if we would do that. And that is what a lot of these nonprofits have popped up to do. And then there's, you know, those mission drifts. So people that used to save the walruses, now all of a sudden they're police accountability experts. And it's really—
Did you say walruses?
I did.
Not the eco-environmental folks.
Listen, I mean, everybody and their mama. When you look at some of the resumes of some of these people, it's like, where did you come from? Oh, you came from there. Why are you here now? Because it's where the money was. It's not the money. They mad they made the jump because I could have told them that money ain't going to last. These foundations, which are part of the problem, philanthropy is part of the white supremacy problem, don't actually care that Black bodies are dying. This is a moment where they want to be able to send out pretty emails about how they're responding to the moment, and the moment's going to pass and the moment did pass. So anyway, it has prevented, slowed down, made it easier for us to be in this moment that we're in, where all of those gains we're seeing now are being rolled back because they weren't real.
I'm speaking with Kat Brooks, Bay Area organizer, co-founder and executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project. Kat, one of the things that you have stated that I admittedly take issue with, I you know, I love you, I appreciate your work, but I have heard you say in the past that the family members of police terror victims, police terror targets, must be in the lead of this struggle against police terror. And I got problems with that. Let me hear your reason why you believe they need to be in the leadership, and then I will give you my thoughts.
Well, I don't know when the last time you heard me say that was, but I guarantee it's been a few years, because when we were doing policy work a few years back, statewide coalition policy work. And when I say policy work, I mean, we call them, you know, non-reformist reforms, i.e. not for body cameras, for things like decertification of police that murder our people. That's an example, right?
Uh-huh.
Or a racial profiling database and actual reporting, because that didn't exist. And so there's no way to hold people accountable. Anyway.
Actual reporting on the number of stops,
yes,
that police make, and the race demographic information on those who are stopped.
Exactly. So things like that. And so and there's a statewide coalition made up of a bunch of organizations that were pushing to get these policies passed. And we were in the work, and people were jockeying for leadership, for power, for final say inside of that coalition, because that's what happens. And people said, well, we're family led, so we should. And other people say, well, we're family led, so we shouldn't. You know, I believe in critique, self-critique. I'm an actual organizer. And I started to think about what that meant, because I was looking at the people that kept saying they were family led, and I didn't see none of their families on the call. And I was like, well, kid, you, APTP said that too, and there ain't no families on this call. I said, huh. And so that for me opened the door to really taking a more critical look at APTP. I can only work on me and my organization and myself mm-hmm. and my positionality mm-hmm. around that. So we stopped saying the movement should be family or we stopped saying that we were family led then. And that was at least 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm. Because that opened the door to having the conversation, then I started to think about it more. And I was like, well, why are we not family led? Like, why am I the one sitting on this call as opposed to, you know, maybe another, as opposed to a family member? And the answer for that for me has become clear through, and I'm not going to call out families, but it's become clear through the engagement with families that I've had. And it was a combination of A, they're not ready, B, they're not organizers, and C, some of their politics is jacked up. And so I do think we should center families. I do not believe that just because your loved one was murdered by cops, it means that you are ready to lead the movement. And I'm going to catch a lot of flack for that. I'll follow that up, though, by saying that inside of our family support group, we actively develop family members into leaders. And you see that manifesting with folks like Mama Dion, whose son James Rivera was murdered, who is now one of the first responders for families in Stockton who go through a similar thing. And she's organizing vigils, and she understands the importance of utilizing the press and communications to get the word out. She understands the importance of connecting family to healing services. She understands the importance of connecting them to other families. She understands what it means to organize a press conference or a delegation to go to a city council meeting and raise hell. And that is because of the intentional work that the team has done with Mama Dion for her to be in that place. Mm-hmm. So they may not start off as folks that should lead. I do believe it is my job as an organizer to help them get there if that is their desire.
Mm. And in one fell swoop, as we say, you just listed all the same criticisms I had.
You know, sure. We don't always start off where we're supposed to be. You know, sometimes it takes time and growth. And if you're willing to do the work on yourself, you get better.
True. If you're willing to do the work, you get better. Absolutely. But yeah, that was the concern that I had. The exact same critique that you just rattled off was the exact same one that I had. And because of time and distance, I was not aware of the internal reflection APTP and you were having. So I still remember that from several years ago. Well, the family should lead. I was like, no, they shouldn't. But at any rate, like I said, you've taken care of what my criticisms were. Like you said, they're not organizers. They don't have that experience. And if they do not have the desire to be organizers, they're not going to become organizers. But I still get frustrated when I see organizations pop up after, because of, due to police terror, and then they're not doing anything around confronting police terror. I'm like, well, we need people in this fight. How do we expect to get some headway if there are, excuse my language, no more soldiers on the field? We need backup. We need reinforcements. And you would think it would come from the family, but not always. So that's a frustration that I have that I wanted to go over with you.
I have a frustration of being 50 years old and trying to figure out, or I want to sit down. I want to do something else. And we as a movement have not developed a field to be, you know, so as you pointed out, the masses of folks that were galvanized, and we were either already organizers as I was, or people became organizers. Mm-hmm. And that pattern just has not continued. And, you know, the 2020, when it collided with COVID, which meant that there were none of us out there to gather up these newly invigorated activists who then mm-hmm. started calling themselves organizers, who absolutely mm-hmm. were not. Now we got a generation of people running around calling themselves organizers and not accountable to nobody. They don't have any structure. They're posting stuff on Blue Sky and calling that organizing. They don't have any political education. They think 2020 was the beginning. I mean, I could go on with the problems, but our movement is in real trouble. I mean, the whole movement, the left, we in trouble, but sticking
to well, yeah, the left, but okay,
my area ahead. Of focus, this fight against state violence, I could count on one hand the people that I think are actually in the field doing the work that needs to be done. And a big piece of that, the biggest piece of that work, as far as I'm concerned, is actually developing the models and alternatives to having to call the police in the first place mm-hmm. and popularizing that work. I can count on one hand the people that are doing that in earnest or righteously. And so that combined with our current federal environment, and the people 100, our state environment, hi Gavin, and here in Oakland, they're two in LA, our local mm-hmm. environment, these cop loving fools, like we're in trouble. And I'm telling people, like, sure, we Oakland and the movement that Oaklanders built, OPD stopped murdering Black people every whip stitch, not just in the year post Oscar, but by the time we got to 2014, 2015, 2016, we were well on the way. Right now, I think mm-hmm. it's 2015, OPD murdered 11 Black men. That's 2015, which was actually the largest rape, even larger than Oscar, but the continuation of that outpouring. OPD's killed 4 people, which is still 4 people too many, but it is also a testament to the power of movement. But what I've been trying to scream from the rooftop, or don't nobody listen to me, is given the political conditions that we're in, they have no real reason to continue not killing us or to be thinking twice before they pull the trigger. And we don't have the soldiers, the movement, the organizers, the strategy, the tactic to really do much about it when they do.
Kat, you spoke earlier about policy work and the issue of decertifying police and the issue of body cameras. Body cameras got and gets a lot more play as a solution or as a bandage on this festering wound. But decertification, I don't think gets as much play as it should. But let our audience know about your position or APTP's position on body camera footage.
Body camera shows the viewpoint of the police, first of all. Second of all, it is reliant upon officers turning on their cameras, not turning off their cameras, or the footage not being buried, edited, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't enough effective guardrails. And then to keep it a buck, we've seen America watch the murders of I don't even know how many Black people there is. Since nigger porn became, you know,
one trauma of porn, yeah,
past times. I mean, I go back and maybe, you know, some Walter Scott. We all watched that happen. And what? It's not an accountability mechanism, and the state, the police officers, the institution of policing itself, they are in control of that mechanism. Well, Kat, isn't it better than nothing? Yeah, I guess, but I'm tired of having that conversation. I'm tired of having the conversation of it's better than nothing.
I know that's right.
Okay. If that's your answer to justify the 1,300 people a year that's murdered by the police, well, we got these body cameras. It's better than nothing. Take your body cameras back, because I'm tired of that argument and I'm tired of having that conversation.
1,300 is still too many people.
That part.
Now, police certification, or should I say decertification. Police officers have to be certified, have to have a quote-unquote license to operate.
Yeah.
And part of the movement has been to remove the certification of particular officers who, you know, act egregiously. And I do remember specifically some of the work that APTP was doing was around the issue of the Police Officers' Bill of Rights here in California.
Mm-hmm.
Complaints against police officers, allegations of brutality, etc., become part of the personnel file of a police officer. And as such, it is private and not available to the public. It is not available for scrutiny. Yep. So a person can make a complaint about a police officer, but they have no way of knowing the status of that complaint, when a hearing was, if the complaint was upheld, if it was dismissed. The only way they really know is if they out on the street and see that same officer. Oh, well, I guess he didn't get fired. I guess he wasn't put on probation. I guess he doesn't have a desk job. And so there was work done around the police officer's Bill of Rights in particular, and that issue of accountability to the public, as opposed to it being a personnel or employee issue. Can you talk about that and where we have come right now here today, 2025, 2026?
Yeah, so there were two really important pieces of legislation that came out of the work around the Police Officers Bill of Rights in California. One was the Transparency Law, 1421, I believe it was called, which gave family members the power, anybody really, because it's just the FOIA request ability after a certain window, once the investigation was closed, to request those records, right? So that people could see what actually happened. When that happened, I'll call out like Long Beach PD, for example, like police, they had literal bonfires, purged their records, got rid of stuff, or did things like we had a family, Teresa Green, who they tried to charge her like $4,000 for the files on the murder of her son, right? But you were supposed to be able to gain more transparency into these cases. The other bill was the police decertification legislation, which was supposed to mean if cops raped, murdered, et cetera, you could prove it, acted horrifically, that they could be decertified. The problem with policy, and when ABTB first started, we didn't do policy at all. And then we got off of our high horses and we're like, the conditions are so bad, we need all roads in. And so while we know that policy ain't going to set us free, we put ourselves in a position where we said, okay, well, we can support policy that maybe gets the white supremacy boot a little bit off the necks of the people, so we got a little more room to maneuver. Mm-hmm. My aha really was with the last bill that I worked hard on that was actually my brainchild, which was the Crisis Act, which was supposed to divert money away from law enforcement and into the hands of grassroots organizations trying to build alternatives for community response to crisis that don't rely on law enforcement. And it, as far as I'm concerned, is a bleep show. The problem with policy is that we in California have done a really good job of getting some really important legislation passed. Like if you, on its face, being able to decertify a cop so they can't make a lateral move, like say Miguel Masso, who murdered Adam Bluford, did. He made a lateral move from New York to Oakland. He murdered people in New York, came to Oakland, murdered 18-year-old Adam Bluford here, and then went to Gilroy, I believe it was Gilroy, one of the cities that way, where he was beating up old people. So you could not do that anymore, make these lateral moves. On the face, that sounds great. The problem with policy is implementation. The people pass this radical, that's in air quotes because it's rational, reform. But then the people, the institution, the entity that we're trying to dismantle, change, transmute, transform, are the ones implementing the stuff. And so God bless some of the very nice people inside of like the Department of Social Services. I'm sure they're very sweet, but they're establishment. And then there's these roadblocks. So for the decertification, that goes through a panel that has cops on it to decide if the cops should even be considered for decertification. So there's a panel of family members and community members, but they're not till after the first panel of the police.
Which is the quote unquote official panel, the panel that has the actual power.
Yeah, and then it goes to the community table and the community say, yes, we recommend this cop for decertification. But then you know where it goes, Tommy?
Where does it go?
Back to the table with the police.
I know that one of the issues with the Police Officer Bill of Rights, like many other issues, was the influence of the police unions in the state of California. Fraternal orders, fraternal societies, associations, not police unions protecting employee rights.
And real spit, when we're talking about policy at the state level, some of these labor unions be some of the problems at the state level. So here at the local level, right, we might, I'm trying to think of someone that a union I could shout out right now. I'm mad at everybody right now. I'll just say SEIU 10-1 may have at one point been on board with challenging, you know, the brutality of the police, right? Everybody was on board in 2020. The statewide SEIU, that's a whole nother conversation because those are their members. They look at it as they've got a union and those are workers. And so we ran into real issues with some of the larger statewide unions around trying to get some of this stuff passed.
Yeah. Back around 2019, I began looking at Instagram and I came across drone photography. And it appealed to me because I have mobility issues, right? I have a disability in terms of my arthritis and being able to get around. And with this drone photography and drone videography, it's like I'm able to travel places I hadn't been able to travel before. And we see now coming from at least that time, drone policing has now taken effect. I've seen where San Francisco PD has been utilizing drones. In addition to drones, we've got facial recognition software. We've got predictive policing. We've got an expansion of surveillance, basically digital technical surveillance. Are these tools, well, we know the answer, but you know, Kat, I wanted you to expound for honest. Can you talk about how these tools either currently do or will disproportionately affect Black and Brown communities?
So I'll just talk about Oakland, right? We just lost, the people just lost a big fight to not have Flock installed in our communities. And Flock is a combination mm-hmm. of everything that you just mentioned, Tandi. It is ALPRs, license plate readers. It is drones. It is in San Francisco, they pull footage from Ring cameras. It is you name it.
Not the Ring camera.
Yes, the Ring camera.
Not the home security system.
The home security and the business security, right? Businesses have Ring technology installed. And here in Oakland, they were already busted for the feds getting their hands on surveillance video footage, which is illegal. And so when OPD was like saying, no, don't worry, we're going to protect the data, or, no, don't worry, we won't give it. And, no, don't worry, we're going to delete it in 30 days. We called garbage because it had already happened. And so actually the people were able to beat it back at a public safety committee meeting. But remember when I was talking about the conditions at the federal, the state, and the local level, here in Oakland, California, we've got, except with the exception of Carol Fife, every single one of our city council members is center right. They changed the rules so they could get it to full council and they just voted that in. And so when you look at it, where the cameras are placed, it's all in the flats and where they plan to place, it's all in the flats. And for folks who don't know Oakland, that's where the Black and Brown people live. The hills are where the white people live. But it's all in the flats. And with the installation of Flock, that means that they can track your Black child from the time they leave the house to get into the bus stop, to get into school, leaving school, to going to kick it with their friends, to coming home, right? It means that your license plate information is being captured and going to God knows where. And they're like, well, it's just a license plate. There's no facial recognition. Stop it. If you take a picture of my license plate, it says Kat Brooks, my address, my height, my weight, my skin color, right? All of those things. And so what we know is that surveillance has never worked out well for Black people ever. And it's not going to now. And we've had incidents here in Oakland where Black folks and Brown folks have been hemmed up as a result of surveillance technology. And a lot of that stuff, like the license plate readers and the facial recognition, they get it wrong. They get it wrong. We have a guy up here, Zachary Norris, who used to be the executive director of the Ella Baker Center, who's now at the Black Organizing Project. They got his license plate reader wrong. And the next thing Zach knew, he was on the ground surrounded by cops with their guns pointed at him. Whoops.
Well, you know, as part of the entertainment complex, these YouTube videos of body camera footage, that's a rabbit hole that I should not be letting people know that I have gone down. Actually, not gone down, I'm still in it. And so much trauma happens around Black people and their interactions with police and cars. You know, back in the day, it used to be a thing about a broken taillight, right? They pull you over for a broken taillight. But now, I mean, coming from LA, we have stories of people who were stopped because of a broken taillight, did not make it back home that evening because of the chokehold, right? The days of Daryl Gates, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But now you have instances where you're just driving along, minding your business. You are following quote unquote traffic laws. Lights light up behind you. You pull over to the side. They read your license plate. And the registered owner of this vehicle has a suspended license or has a warrant. It's like, my God, what is happening? And then the person ends up in the back seat of a police car or the hospital or worse.
I was going to say, the back of the police car is the best case scenario.
Yeah, okay. And that's still horrible.
It's awful. And that's lifelong trauma. Right. It's part of why we're walking around walking wounded. And those kinds of stops, as we know, are the kickoff. They're the kickoff point for so many of the horror stories that make it into the mainstream news and so many of the horror stories that don't.
So earlier, when we began this conversation, Kat, we talked about true justice and accountability. And we look at the case of Oscar Grant, as in the case of so many of our folks who've been murdered by the police. True justice is Oscar Grant home, raising his daughter, Tatiana, home with his mother, Wanda Johnson. No movement, no individual can provide true justice. What is the next best thing, or is there a next best thing?
This is where it's going to sound like I'm circling backwards on something I said earlier when we talked about family should lead.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm okay with that.
Okay.
One of the fights that I get into, that my organization actually at this point gets into with, you know, the real abolitionists, because they don't consider me one, is making this demand, and I'm okay with that too. Mm-hmm. Making this demand that cops go to jail or prison. My position is, if somebody murdered my daughter, nobody has a right to tell me what justice looks like for me.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of these families, that is the only, again, we were talking about, they're not activists, they're not organizers, they're not, you know, all of us with our college degrees and privileged political educational views. Their loved one has been murdered. And for them, that is what will give them some small semblance of solace. And so from the perspective of the families, and I've worked with hundreds at this point, that for them is the next best thing. Mm-hmm. What I want is to stop responding to dead Black people at the hands of law enforcement, right? Like that is where the work is focused, is how do we get to a place where there are less and eventually no more Black people murdered by police.
You want front-end justice.
I want front-end justice. I want the system gone. And that doesn't mean I don't want accountability systems. Doesn't mean that I want people running around doing harm to other folks, because that does happen. That is true. But we invest bazillions of dollars that could actually go into things that actually help reduce crime and violence in our communities, like trauma supports, mental health, jobs, housing, education. We put all of that in this failed system of policing that's supposed to provide public safety that makes Black people and brown people not that much safer. And so that shift isn't going to come from the top. It can only come from us. And so to me, the mandate for those of us in the field doing this work is to build those alternatives, to publicize them, to publicly admit the pieces of them that don't work and retool them so they work better and make the radical rational. I say a lot, I will retire from this work when it becomes absurd to call the police on someone who's in the middle of a drug overdose, when it becomes egregious to call the police on someone in the middle of a mental health crisis, when we have equipped, funded, trained teams that can respond to domestic violence, and when we're funneling as much that we do into policing right now into actually preventing the violence from happening in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's the next best thing. That, however, is not going to happen today.
For a while.
Though there's more progress on that front being made now than ever before.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, I want to ask you about the psychology or the psychological effects and the psychological selves. Now, what do I mean by that? When we talk about accountability, how important do you believe it is of an actual accounting of a person's murder by the police? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, as an example, when Johannes Merzlich murdered Oscar Grant, one of the first things that he did was resign from the BART police, many of us believe, so that he would not have to give an accounting of what happened. You know, whenever there's a police shooting, internal affairs, other police officers sit down with you to get your side of the story. Johannes Merzlich automatically canceled that by resigning, saying, I'm no longer a police officer. Even though, side note, when he went to trial and, you know, he was afforded all of the protections of the police, even though he was no longer a police officer, we'll just put that to the side for a moment. I remember hearing, I talked with Mariam Kaba, She's done incredible work with interrupting criminalization around the issue of basically taking on the entire prison industrial complex and how we talk about abolition and coming up with new ways to imagine safety. But I was in Detroit for the trial of the man who murdered Renisha McBride, Theodore Wafer. And without rehashing all of that story, Pacifica listeners, Hard Knock listeners, please go Google it. One of the things that she said was she was glad he would be held accountable, but it's still not justice. Yeah. And I understand what you're saying about that, but I've talked with family members of police terror victims. And one of the things that they always say is, I just want to know what happened to my child. Mm-hmm. I just want to know, why did you do this? And as a corollary to that, you know, I try to ask family members sometimes, well, what do you want to happen to this person? And for a variety of reasons, they don't always say what they want to happen. Mm-hmm. But my thing is, even if you verbalize, just you verbalizing that you want to see the person who did this to your loved one drawn and quartered in the street, we know it's not going to happen. But it's okay for you to verbalize that, for you to say that out loud. You're hurt, you've been traumatized, and injustice has been inflicted on you. How important is it, how necessary is it for psychological selves, or are there any psychological selves when you're fighting police terror?
I think it's crucial. Is knowing what happened going to remove all of the pain? No, but I can absolutely tell you for a fact it's better when they get to actually know what happened, when they get to actually get the facts, Did Johannes Mejli go into prison for 11 months heal Wanda's soul? Absolutely not.
You sit absolutely down for 5 not
minutes and know that. Mm-hmm. Is she happy he did that time? Did it let her maybe take in a quarter of an inhale? Absolutely. Right. Again, there is no justice other than the person coming back. In lieu of that, you know, what inside of the paradigms that we live in can these families be offered from the very system that is also responsible for the fact that their loved one is dead? The very same system that they turn to for justice is the system that is responsible for their loved one being dead.
Mm-hmm.
So we're asking a murderous system to make atonement for murder.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is enough to send people crazy, and it does.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely does.
It's just like on these body camera videos I watch. You disagree with the cop and you demand a supervisor. So you think that the father is going to come and take your side over his son?
That part.
That's basically what this is. This, yes, a patriarchal institution, this murderous, militaristic institution. You think that the papa gonna take your side over his child? Really? Because they're police, because they're sworn? You really believe that? I'm sorry, that's my little tangent on police. Police and these body camera videos.
Well, I mean, I know we're over time, and so I'll just say this really quickly. I talk a lot these days about cognitive dissonance for Black folks. Right, that we're told from the time that we're in the womb and at school, right? So our babies go to school and the cop comes and he's taught, like, the cop gets, helps the old people walk across the street, and the cop gets the kitty out of the tree. And if something bad happens, you should call the police.
Officer friendly.
And then on the way home, right, on the way back to East Oakland or back to West Oakland or back to South Central, right, they see the police pulling over people that look like them, beating up people that look like them. Maybe they get stopped and interrogated by the police. They get home. The cops are dragging their auntie at the house or beating up their uncle. The daddy gets sent to prison, right? And for far too many of our families, they know someone has been murdered by the police. That creates what is called cognitive dissonance.
Mm.
Where the people that you are told are supposed to keep you safe are the most dangerous people in your community.
Mm.
Which contributes to the mental health, stability, health, of our people and our neighborhoods. We ain't got time to get into all of that, but that is critical.
Like I said, we need a marathon. We need a marathon where we discuss and dissect these issues. Kat Brooks, Bay Area organizer, co-founder, executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project. Thank you so much for being on Hard Knock today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tandi.
I'm Tandi Seasway Shimoringa, sitting in for Davey D, and we'll be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris, Juwan, Kim, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me, yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Yeah.
Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till it ended from the steel grave. Beef, say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say peace to the lovers I name with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast.
Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.